Why do we fall in or out of love? And is there ever such a thing as love at first sight? I'm Dr. Lara Dungan, and in this episode of Science is Everywhere, I'm tackling one of the most thorny questions for us humans, the science of love, attraction, and human relationships. Why do we fall in love? You took my heart and
threw it away. Why did you fall in love? Oh no, did you just fall in love?
Well, it's natural.
I think partly physical attraction.
I suppose in the beginning it's infatuation.
Their bodies get attracted to each other.
I suppose it's chemical reactions in your brain. Yeah.
Lust, need and finances.
Mainly looks, and then love takes over.
So that's a little of what you think the answer is. Lust, money and chemistry. Love is the theme of many of our movies, novels, poetry and songs. But what is the science behind it? And how much of what passes for love is actually just biology, chemistry, physics, or even psychology at play? What is this thing called love? I'm back in my old alma mater, Trinity College Dublin, with Professor Luke O'Neill, who's chair of biochemistry here. Luke, you're an expert in this area. So what is this thing called love?
I think love, on a scientific level, is a glass of wine, candles burning. And no, it's not that. What's fascination, if you're a scientist, or even just a curiosity thing, you say, what is love and why do we get attracted to each other? There's a scientific basis to attraction. We're attracted to each other for biochemical reasons, for immune reasons. So the science of love is all about trying to understand, can we get to the bottom of this wonderful process that is love for humans?
And smell comes into it, doesn't it? What are the elements of smell behind love and attraction?
Yeah, the best science at the moment with regard to love is about smell, interestingly. So they found these really interesting facts that subconsciously we're smelling each other. It sounds terrible, but we are. And we've known about things called pheromones for years. Our sweat is a key place to find these pheromones, and they can attract, you can attract a mate through your scent is really what's going on. And of course, like, perfume manufacturers are investing in this research because maybe some of those perfumes are mimicking this pheromone thing, I suppose.
Are we kind of ruining it if we cover ourselves in deodorants and perfumes? I mean, are you saying kind of the natural smell is the way to go? It's how we attract people?
There's no question that you can mask these scents, and that can really affect things. And a really interesting one is the contraceptive pill. Alters a woman's sense of smell. And there's evidence that women who are on contraceptives often make a bad judgment because they're smelling a guy and they're not quite detecting it correctly because the pill has actually affected their sense of smell. Isn't that terrifying? You wouldn't have realised that.
Terrifying.
You know? Yes, I know, actually, yeah. But what's fascinating there is the woman's sense of smell towards a man differs during her cycle. So when she's at her most fertile, when she's ovulating, basically, then her sense of smell is really ramped up and she's attracted to men in a certain way at that time. And she's selecting out a mate based on his smell that would predict he's going to be a good father and have good genes.
Well, then that brings us into immunology, which is very much your realm. When you're saying they're selecting for the genes, are they selecting for just a very broad spectrum of genes that everybody wants? Or does each person select depending on their own genes?
That's the most fascinating bit, that there's an immune aspect to this. So you will pick a mate who is somewhat similar to you genetically, but not too similar. That's the trick. But you're actually detecting that in your mate. You're saying, oh, well, this mate I'm picking here is a bit like me, but not too like me. Now, they've got to be a bit like you, because often you select a mate with similar interests, similar background often, and that seems to be part of the process. But if they're too like you, then you get these problems. You're sniffing the other person's immune system. Isn't that amazing?
Can you do that?
You can do that, yeah, because the genes you're detecting in the other person are part of their immune system. They're called MHC genes. Now, there's a very good reason for this, because if you do become pregnant, say, right, that will be a baby that can't be too similar to you genetically, first of all, but equally it can't be too different. If it's too different, your immune system will reject that baby. The look of love is in your eyes.
The look your heart can't disguise. So our sense of smell, it seems, is the critical sense driving attraction. And all that musky sweat we try and hide is our secret love weapon. But what about the visual? How we look?
why is it that we all find, you know, George Clooney attractive, or Brad Pitt, or Justin Bieber, whoever, or Angelina Jolie? Why do we all find them attractive? There's been a lot of myths in the literature over the years on attractiveness. One of the most common myths is that it's subjective. And this has been thought of for millennia, basically, that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And one of the things that research into aesthetics has absolutely debunked is that myth. We share our preferences. George Clooney would be out of a career if our preferences weren't universal.
And that's psychologist Fiona Newell at the Institute of Neuroscience in Trinity.
For example, symmetry in a face is preferred, so we like symmetrical faces more than asymmetrical faces. And moreover, symmetry in a face is related to how healthy that individual is. There is some suggestion that what we're looking for in a face are facial cues which are related to the health of that person, and that might then tell us this would be a good person to have offspring with, for example. The menstrual cycle can affect our preferences for the types of men that we find attractive. So when we're ovulating, for example, females tend to prefer very masculine-looking males, really grisly-looking males. But outside of that small window, that ovulation time, we prefer males that have more feminized faces, that look more honest and not so dominant or domineering. And what we think is behind that is this trade-off between good genes versus the risk of him taking flight and not looking after the offspring, if you like.
That's really interesting. This idea that how healthy people look is the way we define beauty, and that who we are attracted to can change based on whether we need a mate or someone to stick around and take care of the babies. But can something as simple as a colour make women more attractive? Well, it seems so.
Yeah, there's been a fair bit of science done on this. The question is, when women are ovulating, are they sending out a signal? But it turns out they wear more red, so they're very clear correlation now with wearing red clothes. And then they got men to rate women wearing either a red dress or a blue dress. And there was a massive increase in the attractiveness, if you like, of a woman in a red dress. So we suspect the red colour is a sign of good genes and good overall health status.
So after Luke O'Neill told me about the red dress, I had to test that it was true. I took a photograph of a very nice looking young woman, one with her wearing a white dress and the other with her wearing the same dress but in red, and asked men at random in the street how they rated her from 1 to 10, starting with that red dress.
I'd rate her as a 9.
8.
I'd go for a 9.
I think she's an 8.
I rate her as an 8.
I think she's hot. Yeah, 10 out of 10. I got my red dress on tonight.
Dancing in the dark in the pale moonlight. So after a hot rating of 8 to 10, I tried a different group of guys with the same woman in the same dress, but this time in white.
Ah, decent 7.
I'd agree with that, yeah, 7.
The white dress. I'd say she looks like she's had work done, so I'd say probably 5.
I think she's a 3.
I think she's a 7.
So there you go. Out of 15 men, the red dress rated far higher than white, confirming that red is indeed sexy. But so much of this is about sexual attraction, the pull of lust and the biological urge to find a good mate. But what about love itself? What is happening in our bodies and brains when we move from lust to love? Scientist Niamh Shaw says lust is phase one, attraction is phase two, and the love thing, well, that hopefully follows.
When you find someone attractive, then you desire them. And when you desire someone, you get these lovely release of chemicals like dopamine. Then you fall in love. Serotonin levels start to drop. You get anxious around that person. So you have a tendency to maybe release a little bit of adrenaline. You can't sleep. You can't eat because you're just obsessed with this object of your affection. And that will last for a while. And then the third phase is attachment. So after you come out of that limerent state where your serotonin levels are very low, they eventually go back up to normal. And then you enter a new phase in a relationship, which is the commitment phase or the attachment phase. And what keeps people together in that phase? Well, they believe that it is something to do with the release of other chemicals in our body. Two in particular, one is called oxytocin, which is known as the cuddle drug. And another one is vasopressin. And vasopressin is released in our kidneys and it's to basically regulate our thirst level. But it also has something to do with monogamy. This lady, Diane Witt, a psychologist in New York, has studied the effect of these chemicals, oxytocin and vasopressin, on other animals. Prairie voles are extremely committed little creatures and they tend to form pairs and they tend to be committed for life. If you suppress oxytocin and vasopressin in prairie voles, they immediately break their bond and they go off and fornicate with others and don't care about their offspring or their life partner, prairie vole. Oh, can't you see the drug for me? And also it's been shown that a mother will release oxytocin when she looks at a photograph of her baby. We release oxytocin when we hug or when we embrace. And dogs also release oxytocin if their master looks at them in the eye and they look at their master. So it's this drug that we release to each other that actually compounds our commitment and attachment to each other.
Okay, so love is actually a drug. And I guess then when we say we fall out of love, levels of that drug, oxytocin, have fallen. And if someone cheats on us, they may be lacking vasopressin. So it really is true. It's more about them than you. Eva McGlycett is an evolutionary geneticist, and she was involved in the Love Lab experiments at the Science Gallery, where they explored this.
So there's a little bit that's known about the genetics of what mate you might choose. And there's one gene, the vasopressin receptor, and there's a long and a short form of this. And depending on which form you have, you're going to be monogamous or not. And so there's some people who suggest that, you know, it should be one of those pieces of information you exchange on a first date, you know, like what's the length of your vasopressin receptor. When I fall in love,
it will be forever. If fidelity is based on genetics, hormones and chemicals, are humans actually designed to be monogamous?
Humans are what known as a partially monogamous. So the orangutan, for instance, is fully monogamous. Mates for life, no question. Chimpanzees are highly promiscuous. They're always looking for mates. Humans are in the middle of all the primates. So we're not quite fully monogamous and we're not polygamous either. You know, so we're kind of in the middle, which is interesting. I mean, that might mean that we're supposed to have more than one mate and maybe men want to spread their wild oats, whatever the phrase is, you know, and have lots of different children. So, but then again, we are bonded with the main partner and there's hormones that drive that. But occasionally, sadly, humans stray. Men and women, it's not just one or the other. And that seems to be part of the process.
Birds do it, bees do it, even educated fleas do it, let's do it, let's fall in love.
So is love unique to humans? Or was Cole Porter right that literally every species does it? Professor Emma Teeling at the UCD School of Biology and Environmental Science sees the hand of Darwin and evolution in love.
Do it. Let's fall in love.
So I think love evolved because we do much better working together in a society. They've done long-term studies that primate offspring, they have a much better chance of survival if they're kept within the family group. If there's a postmenopausal female around to help raise offspring, the offspring have a much better chance. And I know I'm lucky because I have the grandmothers involved and helped me raise my own children, so it really, really does help. So I think love has evolved as a way to keep us together.
Electric eels, I might add.
The question is love only a human feeling or not? It's very hard for us to understand behaviour of other animals because we're a single type of species. But then if you observe this behaviour and try and not anthropomorphise it, so try and not put your own ideas, human ideas on it, it's very difficult. I mean, think about wolf packs. Think about how birds interact together. Think about an elephant crying when the baby dies, or nursing babies and going back and nursing the bones of dead relatives. So if you can define what love is, and this seems like a love-like behaviour, then, you know, why not? If love is something that's evolved to maintain society, to bring about sociality, any social species then perhaps should experience love.
So we're genetically and biologically hardwired for love. But what about this idea of love at first sight?
Yeah, there is. Because I fell in love with my first love at first sight. I married him. And I'm 40 years with him.
No, I think that that's probably all about attraction, and there are lots of reasons to be together. But I think that love is much deeper than that.
It happened with me, and I'm married now nearly 60 years.
No, I don't. I think you get to know somebody. You think you like somebody at first sight, but not love. No.
I think there is. Yeah, I've experienced it myself. Yeah, I think there can be, strangely.
No, don't think so, no. That's only a sign, love at first sight.
No. Yeah, well, that's different. You were... No, I don't... I don't think so, not really. I can't take my eyes
off you. We're looking at each other the whole time and picking up cues. So symmetry is a key thing. If the face is symmetrical, it's more attractive. Women look for broad shoulders in a man. And this has been proven now, you know. And of course, men look for the waist-hip ratio is key. And that goes into your brain and suddenly you feel attracted. So I think you can have instant attraction. There's no question of that. Now, whether that's the same thing as love, I'm not so sure. But it has to begin with attraction. So there can be attraction within less than a second, amazingly, they've shown scientifically.
I think maybe it's attraction at first sight. You know, I differentiate between the two. You know, how can you love somebody if you don't even know them? But you can be exceedingly attracted to somebody because they have whatever attributes you find that you are believing will indicate that they're a good mate. So love at first sight, I think that's probably a bit too deep. But definitely have deep attraction at first sight that can lead to love.
That's scientists Luke O'Neill and Emma Teeling there, throwing cold water on love at first sight. But then again, science can't always dictate everything. As Hitchcock psychiatrist Dr. Florence Peterson, played by Ingrid Bergman in Spellbound, discovers when she ends up falling for a man she knows nothing about, and who, because of his own amnesia, knows nothing about himself.
I think the greatest harm done to the human race has been done by the poets.
Oh, poets are dull boys, most of them, but they're not especially fiendish.
Why, they keep filling people's heads with delusions about love. Writing about it as if it were a symphony orchestra and a flight of angels.
Which it isn't, eh?
Of course not. People fall in love, as they put it, because they respond to certain hair coloring, or vocal tones, or mannerisms that remind them of their parents.
Or sometimes for no reason at all.
Well, that's not the point. The point is that people read about love as one thing and experience it as another.
And of course, poor old Florence has to eat her words. The moment I saw him smile. But if love at first sight isn't possible, what about that old idea that opposites attract?
Yeah, to me, opposites would definitely attract, yeah. In my relationship, because the two of us are like chalk and cheese.
I don't think that opposites attract.
I think opposites attract in some instances, whether or not it's conducive to a healthy, long-lasting relationship. The jury's out on that one.
Well, as Luke O'Neill told us, genetically, we need to select partners who are different but not too different from us. And history bears this out, according to social historian Mary E. Daly of UCD, who says census records show we marry those within our social circle, literally the boy or girl next door.
I don't think social history shows opposites attracting. I think there are obviously exceptions to every rule, but I think the general rule is a degree of almost physical compatibility, cultural compatibility and social compatibility is often the attraction. There's a very good book that looks at couples and asks them about sex, courtship, marriage and so forth. And in an awful lot of instances, there's a physical attraction, but I think there's also a physical attraction that is in some ways either constrained or enhanced by social compatibility. And I think that's really the way you have to think of it. I think possibly nowadays people feel less constrained by the second and therefore perhaps more willing to take risks.
But what about love and marriage itself?
Love and marriage go together like a horse and carriage.
I'll leave the last word to four experts, two couples I met who've been conducting some long-term experiments.
How long have we known each other now?
About 22 years.
No, more.
A bit more?
28.
28 years?
Yeah.
All right.
This is an awful lot for me.
Yeah, we didn't go out with each other then. We were just paddling around.
You wanted to go out with me, but you know what I mean? But we kind of were friends, and then, you know, friends kind of turn into something else then.
Yeah.
Maybe we used to kind of be always together, like all our friends, and then we just kind of start going out together, and then you pop the question, didn't you?
I suppose I did, yeah. Forced into it, but 20 years made then. In March it was 20
March,
years.
Yeah. Next March, yeah.
And still the same as it always was.
Oh, yeah, lovey, dovey, dovey.
I could say that a little bit more convincing now, in fairness.
Sorry. You can't have
one without the other. We met when we were both in college. That was 42 years ago.
Yeah, but it wasn't love at first sight. Not for me, anyway. No, I'd be a slow burner.
Yeah. Well, my parents were engaged after 2 weeks, so I reckon there has to have been love at first sight there.
Do you guys think you're opposites?
We're different, but we have enough in common. And opposites really means like the people are opposite end. I think what happens in those situations is that people, they have a very dynamic, short relationship, and then boom, it just becomes too much. The more long-term relationships are about compatibility and, yeah, differences, but compatibility.
Yeah.
Are we the same, or are we?
No, we're slightly different.
Slightly,
yeah. Height-wise and personality-wise, like both.
Majorly different, yeah.
So I think it does kind of work out now and again.
So life pretty much supporting the scientists there. Next, in Science is Everywhere, I'm talking H2O, water. That substance that is all around us, but which we are sometimes reluctant to drink. Like, would you drink a glass of it from the River Liffey?
No, I would not. There is a risk of Wales disease.
If it was filtered, I would drink it, yes.
No, I wouldn't drink water from the Liffey.